Today, where are we with breaking up the banks? Hello, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. I've got Robbie Barwick with me from the CEC. Hello, Robbie.
Hello, Martin.
Good to have you on board. Thanks for spending the time with us. It would be great to, I think, start this conversation with a little bit of an outline of what the CEC is and what your role is, because you've been very active recently with regard to breaking up the banks.
Yeah, so the CEC is the, I'd say almost the oldest and most successful of the minor political parties in Australia. We've been going for 30 years. I work from the national headquarters in Melbourne. The CEC started in reaction to the early impact of the neoliberal reforms that began in the early 1980s. And we started in rural Queensland around Kingaroy, but then spread around Australia, because what we've always represented is the people in the real part, like in the real economy, who were systematically displaced by the financialization of the economy that came along with these neoliberal reforms, right? So whereas once upon a time, not that long ago in the early 80s, manufacturing and agriculture would have been the biggest sectors of the economy, today it's financial services. And that is, most of that is completely non-productive. It's passing money around and everyone involved taking a cut, right? So we've been opposed to that process in the economy all along. And from the mid-80s on, we were forecasting that this had to lead to a crash. And that's exactly what happened, of course, in 2008, which Australia, you know, barely avoided. Only, you know, the story of Australia surviving the crash is exaggerated. Our banks came very close to going under. From the crash onwards, though, we saw through our associate in the United States, we have an association over there with the American economist Lyndon LaRouche. His organization and like-minded people around the world you could see that the nub of the problem was this cancerous speculation that had grown up. But also you could see that a lot of it, not all of it, but a lot of it in terms of the scale of it, had to do with the repeal of this law in 1999, the Glass-Steagall Act, which had separated normal banking from the rest of the financial services industry. And that repeal, you could see, well, that was insane. It, you know, just allowed this explosion of speculation. So if that's what led us to this, it makes sense to go back to that system that worked. And we think that should be a general policy worldwide, not just for the United States.
Let me just come back then. So what we've, because you've touched on two really important points. The first is the financialization of society, which essentially is about the fact that more and more and more of society is effectively directly financial services related, right?
Yep.
And that means that financial services, rather than being a service industry to enable real productive things to happen in the economy,
that's right,
has become a profit center in its own right. And in fact, a lot of the smart minds around the world are now in the financial services sector and are taking, where they can, taking positions to be able to actually speculate on future movements. But it's all disconnected from the real economy, right? That's what financialization means.
Absolutely, right? Disconnected. That's the big problem. Yep. And more people need to see that. Politicians need to be making policies accordingly, but they, you know, it's one of the frustrating things in today's society is a lot of people can't distinguish the difference between if the Ford Motor Company shut down operations in Geelong and that site became a shopping mall, a lot of politicians wouldn't think there's much difference. And of course, there's a huge difference. One is an engine of production, one is just, you know, retail, and it's collecting money at the end of the process. And you've got to be able to distinguish the difference. You're either going to have a productive economy or you're going to have something that's not and dominated by financial services, which, the best anecdote or analogy is to your parasite. It becomes a parasite. It's feeding off a host rather than contributing to the rest of the economy, how it's supposed to.
Right. So basically, the financial services sector clips the ticket on the way through, and effectively there are lots of people in the long line all clipping the ticket, right? And so they get effectively wealthier and wealthier. But in terms of actually true productive output that actually makes a difference to the broader society, then they really are not actually doing any of the heavy lifting.
No, and eventually undermining it.
Right.
There was a shocking report produced in January or February by an investment house in London that said Australia's big four banks are a global systemic threat. And what was interesting about its analysis was it based it on the size of the financial services industry here, the financial sector, and it's done these analogies. Look, when four banks account for a quarter of your stock market, right, that is a huge problem, and it becomes even by their measures of economic growth, they were saying, look, it becomes a drag on growth, and of course it does. All this debt that's drowning us in Australia, this massive household debt, etc., it's been generated through this process, and it's been held by people that have been flipping this stuff all the way through, as we've said.
Yeah, so and it's interesting that nearly half of the dividends paid in Australia come from the financial sector, right?
That'd be, yeah.
It's huge. So basically we've got this self-perpetuating financialization machine that's becoming bigger and bigger and bigger and lifting home prices and, you know, making unproductive loans all over the place. And in fact, preferring to lend into the housing sector, which is just lifting home prices and therefore making people pay more, rather than investing productively into commercial prospects and opportunities. So
that's right.
And this is not just a local thing. This is a global thing that's happened over the last 20 to 30 years since the liberalisation of the financial system regulation, which takes us right back to Glass-Steagall. Because basically, if you go back in history, you know, Glass-Steagall was in the 1930s initially in the US because they had a crash and people were realising that there was a lot of speculation built into the banking system, and that then flooded over into the normal banking system. It was then subsequently repealed, and that's allowed all these organizations to effectively get bigger and bigger and bolt on more and more types of business, firstly, and secondly, to get more and more involved in the speculative aspects of financial services.
There were problems in the financial system, of course, as we had identified before the repeal of Glass-Steagall, but if I give you one metric, which is the BIS's figure for global derivatives, outstanding derivatives contracts, from 86 until 1999, it had grown from zero to about $100 trillion. Then they repealed Glass-Steagall. And by 2005, it had grown to more than $700 trillion in the next 5 years. It was growing at the same, more than the same, every year at the same rate it had taken 13 years to grow before that. And that's what Glass-Steagall did. The separated banks were part of the real economy, people's deposits, real savings, etc. Once they could get those, then the scale became enormous of the amount of speculation that they were able to do, and that's what led to the blow up in the system.
And in fact, it's very hard to put your finger on the real total risks in the system, because effectively you've got bets on bets on bets across a whole bunch of different products and services in the derivatives sector, you know, swaps and options and futures and all those things. And it's very hard to pin it down and work out where all the risks go. And the other point there is that these risks will not show until things start to move against us, which is exactly what happened in 2008. So effectively,
you don't know who's swimming naked until the tide goes out.
Mr. Warren Buffett, one of my favourite quotes. Okay, so basically we've got the financialization globally and locally, and we've got the banks into many different things, including the speculation. And I think it's also worth just highlighting the banks in Australia have also got expanded into other product ranges, so, you know, wealth management, insurance. So they've expanded, if you like, laterally, and they've also expanded vertically as well. So effectively they've got advisor groups as well as distribution channels and manufacturing. So effectively, the financial system here has got bigger and wider and more risk-laden. That's where we are at the moment.
That is where we are at the moment. And along has come the Royal Commission. And, you know, if you go, actually, Martin, it's people should look up the letters patent for the terms of reference for the Royal Commission, because the whole first page is this glowing piece about how wonderful the banks are. And you get to the bottom, you think, well, why do we need a Royal Commission then, right? But, you know, within the first week of hearings of those Royal Commissions, that whole first page is completely discredited. And instead of us, what we've got to realise is, okay, we don't, what the Royal Commission has shown is we don't just have banks that are into misconduct. The type of misconduct has to draw into question how sound they really are. The home lending, if a lot of their mortgages was required them going into all this lending to unaffordable people and committing fraud to do it, right, they've created a huge risk there. The gouging of customers through the vertical integration, you know, we need to start seeing what percentage of their profits, which are massive profits, world record profits, what percentage of their profits has come from this activity, right? Because if I suspect we're going to see, we can get a sense of what their real profits would have been without all this, and they would look nowhere near as good as they tried to appear for many, well, they got away with appearing for many, many years. And that's our worry. These are, we don't want the banks broken up just to protect people, but that's an important part of it. There's no other way to do it, to protect them from their kind of gouging. We want them broken up to protect the economy so that they can't be a systemic risk to the economy.
One of the interesting observations there that the Productivity Commission observed was that banks' behaviour was driven fundamentally by short-term profit motives, irrespective of the outcomes for customers, right? And then, of course, the Royal Commission is also highlighting again the fact that it's all being driven by short-term profit gains. The culture's bad. There's probably criminal activity there as well. And everywhere you look, it's, you turn over every stone, whether it's insurance or whether it's wealth management or retail banking, you see the same basic behaviour. In fact, Philip Lowe gave his address today in front of the Senate Estimates and said, there's a question on trust, there's a question on risk, and there's a question on customer outcomes. Well, those are the three fundamental building blocks of financial services. So basically, there's a big fail there, right? So we have to move on from saying, yeah, we see the problem. And actually, I tell you, I think a lot of people still don't get there's a real problem, right? Because there's so much else going on. But as soon as you start looking at the Royal Commission and the productivity, all of the reports are calling out the same issues, right? So now we have to think about, so where do we go? So what is the recipe for dealing with the situation that we've got? Okay, so the first thing is obviously the Glass-Steagall. Now you guys have been very active now in bringing the Glass-Steagall back on the table in Australia. So let's cover that now, shall we?
Okay. Well, so we've been pushing it for 10 years, and in that time, until the last 12 months, we got virtually zero traction here in Australia. We were also heavily involved with the campaign for Glass-Steagall in other countries. So I went to the UK a few times, etc. And it was really advanced in the United States and America. The debate around this is really advanced. And it's so advanced that what you see is there's one vested interest stopping it, which is the banks, right? And it's going to, it's pretty transparent. It's going to come down to that. But what's also interesting is the caliber of the people that are enthusiastic supporters of Glass-Steagall. You know, so it's people like, and the two names that stick out to me the most is in the United Kingdom, the main champion of it is Lord Nigel Lawson, who was Margaret Thatcher's Chancellor of the Exchequer. He was involved. He led the deregulation of the City of London in 1986, the Big Bang. He's honest enough that following the 2008 crash, he did a mea culpa and said, you know, we were wrong. We did not intend this consequence to happen. Therefore, that result from deregulation, we have to reverse that, right? He's very, and in the United States, similar, the man who was credited with getting Glass-Steagall repealed, Sanford Weill, so that he could merge with Citibank and create Citigroup, in 2012, he came out and said, we were wrong. We have to go back to that separation. Banking can't work any other way. And what they describe, Martin, is that they describe banking versus everything else is different species, right? In investment banking, probably shouldn't even be called banking in that respect, but that's what it's become known as. So the different species of things keep them apart. So, but in the last 12 months, suddenly here it's taken off. It took off on the back of the government pushing through this bill to give APRA crisis resolution powers. Now, this is the bail-in power, right? And they denied it could be used for deposits, but we showed that, no, there's wording in there that's so loose, so broad, that in a scenario in the future, you cannot rule out they could use that to interpret deposits as capital that they could convert to prop up a bank. And that got people's attention. And when we took that to Parliament, and I got to go to Parliament with Dr. Wilson Tsai, former principal researcher at APRA, who had come out and confirmed everything we were saying, members of Parliament started to sit up and take notice. And we got there the day this crisis resolution bill went through the House of Representatives, and a day before it was rushed through the Senate with only 8 senators present, didn't even have a vote. People were saying, well, what do we do? It's already law, effectively. And we were able to say to them, all right, well, what we need is to supersede that with another law that can stop that being used by making banks safe, so there's not even a question of them ever giving into the risk of failure, and that's Glass-Steagall. And that started making sense to people. So Bob Catter, the member for Kennedy, agreed to introduce a bill. We drafted a bill. Our bill is based very closely on the United States Glass-Steagall Act, plus the 21st Century Glass-Steagall Act, which is a bill in front of the current US Congress, which has been updated for modern financial realities like derivatives, etc., right? And we were able to get that introduced into Parliament on the 25th of June. And so what we have now, there is a bill in Parliament that can solve what we consider to be the fundamental issues with the banking system, problems of conflicts of interest that come from vertical integration, and the problems of this risk that the of the speculative activity being borne by the depositors, right? Our bill achieves that.
Okay, so it's in Parliament. What happens now, though? How does it get moved forward?
Well, that's the question. And all of this, all the progress we've made so far has been driven by ordinary people, everyday Australians, who have come to understand this issue, getting involved in our campaign to push it. And I cannot overstate how valuable that is, because we've generated thousands, and I mean literally thousands of interactions from everyday citizens with their members of Parliament. And that's what's opening doors for us. The worst problem with most members of Parliament is not that they're bad people. It's they are run off their feet. They have a million distractions. I've been in queues of 200 people long to get through the security to go to Parliament. Every one of those people has an issue, right? And that's before the media come along and make soap operas out of every little thing, you know? So we have to push and push hard. And when they feel it, when they start to feel it from their electorate, then they sit up and take notice. So that's how we got the bill introduced. That's how we're going to get it further. At the moment, it's not going to even be debated in the House of Representatives, unless either the government agrees to it, to debating it, or unless the Labor Party suddenly comes out and says, okay, we support that, but then you'd still need two members of the government to cross the floor to support a vote to let it be debated, right? So we have to push hard to demand they do that, because at the moment, as far as we're concerned, as long as they don't let that bill to be debated, they're still protecting the banks just like they were until November last year, right? So that is the message. And people have to demand they let this bill, it's called the Banking System Reform Separation of Banks Bill 2018, let that bill be debated. Now, if they don't, there is a chance, though, that we may be able to use the Senate as an avenue. So what's happened is last week the Greens came out and they've said for a couple of years that they want to end vertical integration, but they've never actually followed through on that. Once our bill was introduced, it's obviously made the Greens sit up and take notice. They came out and clarified exactly what they meant, which is effectively what we mean. They endorsed full separation. In some respects, they even went a little bit further, saying that different sectors should only be those sectors and not be conglomerates of different types of businesses. And then Professor Alan Fells came out, the former ACCC commission, and fully endorsed that. Right, so now we've got people like Alan Fells adding his name to some of these very prominent people around the world saying banking system has to be broken up. And that, if we can get there may be a chance to get the bill somehow introduced into the Senate After it's, if they don't let it be voted on in the House of Representatives, after about 8 sitting weeks, it expires, right? So if at that time it's introduced into the Senate, the Greens would probably support a parliamentary committee to examine it, have a proper inquiry, which generates more publicity, forces the major parties to take a position on it. And that's the territory you want to be in politically, because if you force the parties to take a position on this law now, with the Royal Commission going on, they'd have to come up with some pretty damn good reasons not to support Glass-Steagall.
So message one then, this is very much a groundswell. You know, individuals need to actually pick up the phone or send an email or write a letter, right? And basically say to your politicians, this needs to be debated, right? Because effectively it's going to be the force of will ground up, you know, from you know, the populace, right? Because this is not going to happen top down. You're not going to have, you know, senior politicians in any party flying the flag for this thing. It's just too far from where they come.
There's a lot of individuals in the major parties that individually, you know, in full agreement, but party structure is too powerful, so it's only going to come from that. And the first step is just keep it simple: let the bill be debated, mm-hmm. right? Okay. Because we can achieve this in stages. And I also tell people, have to be persistent. You know, don't let them put you off. Some MPs will be better than others, but just keep pushing it. Just harass them. It doesn't matter. They're there to, like, you can harass them on. They get harassed on all types of issues, including real small local issues.
Yeah.
Right, let them be harassed by the public on an issue of fundamental reform of the financial system that's going to benefit all of us.
And I guess the other point there is, and you touched on, is the Royal Commission, when they release their report later in the year, they will probably have something to say on vertical and horizontal integration based on what they've been looking at. Of course, there are some limitations on what they can and what they can't talk about.
We hope so. We hope that they say something. They have certainly asked questions, probing questions of the government and the regulators, etc., about it. We also hope that the restrictions that they have noticed themselves, that the restrictions in the terms of reference were political, because, say, for instance, APRA is on the stand today for the first time and looking really dodgy, because they are dodgy. They're a terrible regulator. They've been captured at a minimum. Right, we call them a fig leaf for self-regulation, and normally what happens is they get questioned sometimes by parliamentarians in parliament who aren't very well qualified to ask the right questions. At least in the Royal Commission today, they were getting questioned by lawyers who had done their homework beforehand and knew what to zero in on, and they were very uncomfortable with that kind of questioning. So the Royal Commission can sort of break out of its limitations, we hope, and do something. Before Fraser Anning gave his controversial speech in Parliament this week, he had succeeded in doing two very important things. That's one of the reasons I was up there. There was an event for bank victims that was very well presented, and it really showed just how the Royal Commission limitations were doing an injustice to the real problem out there. And then later that afternoon, he was able to get a unanimous motion passed through the Senate to extend the Royal Commission's terms of reference, time and resources, right? So that's there now. We don't know if that's going to be taken up or not, but they should. However, what we're saying is, with this policy, how much more evidence do we need? It would be good for the Royal Commission to come out and endorse it or hand it, but we don't even have to wait for that. The evidence is there. That's why people like Alan Fowles have decided to come out now and just force it.
So one other question which occurs to me is that, there's a lot of concern about the behaviour of the banks and, the wealth managers and insurers. But in the mainstream media, there's almost no discussion at all about Glass-Steagall or financialisation or, if you like, those broader strategic issues that we've touched on. Why do you think that is?
Well, I'm pretty confident in saying that the single biggest sector that advertises in Australia would be the banks, would be the financial sector. And I can tell you now, that is a huge restriction for a commercial media. You know, there's a limit to what they're ever going to do. And see, it's one thing to go after a particular banking issue like a like CBA and the money laundering or whatever, you know, because you're not talking about a total chain dismemberment of how they work. What our bill is, right? And the banks hate it. The reason they didn't get it, with all the support in the UK, the reason they didn't get it passed is because the banks dug in. In the United States, Wall Street still owns the US Congress, right? And they have dug in. Even though Donald Trump campaigned on Glass-Steagall, they dug in. And they hate this more than anything else because it cuts them off from their access to deposits for their gambling, right? So we're not surprised by that. And therefore, it's almost instinctive with these with media to steer away from it fundamentally. Now, the Royal Commission has opened up some cracks, right? And we hope there's going to be some more. So that's part of it. The other part of it is I think that the media in Australia, you know, there's a lot of assumptions about the Australian economy they've never questioned, right? I heard someone on Sky News just before saying that, Philip Lowe was warning, we haven't had a recession for 27 years, but we will have one eventually. And people said, oh, that's going to be tough. Well, I would say to Philip Lowe, do you realise there's a whole sector, there's a whole sort of periphery of the Australian economy, they may as well have been in recession for 27 years, right? And that's all just dismissed and ignored. You don't have this political revolt we're having around the world if everything's fine in the economy. It's all economically driven, and people get sick of the lies that they've been told, and they're just saying, my life is not working out, right? I might be a paper millionaire with my house, but my kids can't afford a house, so what's the point of that, you know, or whatever. Or I might have a job, but it's 1 hour a week, you know, so I'm not counted as unemployed. These structural changes to our economy over 40 years, this is the reason the CEC exists. We've always addressed this stuff, but the media, they just accepted all the claims as, oh, you know, this is a wonderful economy. And there's neoliberalism has been a consensus for 40 years, including in the media. Well, it's now breaking down, and the Australian media is like, they're not very smart. They're slow to catch on, I feel, right? So, you know, I see some signs with some certain individuals, but in general, I think the political change will happen before the media catch on, and then they'll just report it happening.
Yeah, after the event.
After the event, yeah.
Okay. No, that's good. So I think that's been really helpful, certainly to understand a little bit about financialization, Glass-Steagall, and the vertical and horizontal integration. And clearly we're at a bit of an inflection point here, because effectively with the Royal Commission and other things happening, and indeed the international uncertainty because of the amount of, you know, debt around the world and the bubble everywhere, right? So we're at a bit of an inflection point there. I think the next few months is going to be a really interesting few months, and hopefully some of the things that we'll see will actually take us towards a future where some of the financial services stuff is put back in its box and it becomes back to a more productive enabling capability in the economy rather than end in itself.
That's the plan. That's what we've got to achieve.
Okay. Well, fingers and toes crossed, and we'll check back in a few months perhaps and see how the journey is going. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Martin. And just anyone can get in touch with our office if they want to get involved. Get onto our website, on the CEC website, and yeah, just participate.
And I'll put a link in the comments below for anybody who's watching this on YouTube. Thank you very much, Robbie. Have a great day.
Thanks, Martin. Bye-bye.